2SER's Arts and Culture Show.
Don't make me say it's so hot right now.
Tan caliente ahora!
Your weekly dose of arts and culture.
And all of that sort of stuff.
It's that weird thing that they're classics because they're classics because they're classics, and then they become the classics and everyone wants to do the classics because they're classics.
He's amazing.
Well, you need a lot of room for all that blood.
And he's hot as a firecracker.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now. You better not use me saying that.
Amazing babes.
On 2SER 107.3.
Hello, hello. You are listening to So Hot Right Now. My name is Sophie Light, taking you through all the way midday with your weekly dose of arts and culture. And oh my gosh, do we have a massive, and when I say massive, I mean godly show for you today. Blake Howard from Gaggle of Geeks, our weekly pop culture guru. He'll be chatting about all the things that are happening in the Star Wars world. There's been a lot of talk about the Han Solo movie, so he's going to be giving us a wrap of that, plus a review of American Gods, which finished up this week. I'm also going to be playing you a chat that I did with its lead star, Ricky Whittle, who was in town for Supernova. I managed to catch up with him, so you'll hear a bit of that chat as well. Also, next week, Keep Sydney Open are having not a rally, but a festival to protest. Protest festival, one would say, to kind of keep the King's Cross alive. So we're going to be chatting with the founder, Tyson Coe, about that as well. But coming up next, we're really close to NAIDOC Week, and one of a landmark play is called Corindoc, and that's actually been performed this week at Riverside Theatres. We're going to be talking to one of the actors all about the play as well. But to kick things off, here's a tune from S. Carey, also known as a guy, the drummer from Bon Iver. This one's called Crown the Pines. You're in 2SER.
In love with this place, but I fear for its grace. Shoot the sky, opens up like the sea, and the resin is covered. Something defined, but I can see the trees of the land.
You can't
escape this place.
Goodness in my father.
Silver Cadillac there by Low Fly Incline. On top of that, you heard from S. Carey of Bon Iver fame with Crown the Pines. You're here on 2SER.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
Corranderk is a play about what could have been, depicting the real-life struggles of its Aboriginal inhabitants to keep living on the land during an era of protectionist policies. Presented by the Ilbijeri Theatre Company, Belvoir and Riverside Theatres, the play will be performed for one day only this Wednesday at the Riverside Theatres in Parramatta. And joining you on the line is one of the play's performers, Jesse Butler. Good morning, Jesse.
Morning, Sophie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks.
Now, Corranderk, it's an incredible story, but it's not that well known. So for people who don't know, what is it about?
Yeah, well, first of all, people shouldn't feel too bad about not knowing about it because, you know, this is the problem. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot of these stories, not even Indigenous people. So it's great to be able to tell it. And it's basically a story about how the land at Corranderk, which is a beautiful reserve about 60 kilometres outside of Melbourne, northeast, and it was about how they were fighting to be self-sustainable and basically to be treated as equals and run the land how they had been running it, which they were running it really well, and they were flourishing and they were making money and they were winning awards at the show with all the produce that they were producing and the hops that they were growing. And then the Aboriginal board who were put together supposedly to protect them, but basically they wanted the land back for themselves and to give it to soldiers that were returning and all that sort of stuff. So they basically sabotaged the place and tried to take it off them. So it's basically about the Aboriginal people joining together with each other and with a couple of really great white people who are in the story, which we love, who were helping them to basically to fight to win the land back.
Yeah, I mean, this was set in the late 1800s when, you know, protectionist policies were well and truly gung-ho. For people who don't know, how bad were these policies?
Well, I mean, it's when you sit there and you listen to what the supposed experts are saying and just the words they're using to describe Aboriginal people and the conditions that they should be under. It's just it's almost comical how bad they were and how Aboriginal people were just basically treated like animals, herded like cattle through different places and just displacing them everywhere, bringing people from all around the country to live together so that they would, you know, they wouldn't feel comfortable around people they knew. But the problem is Aboriginal culture, you know, everyone is able to come together and learn each other's language and really be stronger together. So these policies that were sort of placed upon them, Aboriginal people at the time, they were really fighting against it, and they kind of used a lot of the things that they were given to fight back against these policies.
For sure. And you mentioned before, like, people don't really know many of the stories, not even Aboriginal people. Is it because, like, unlike when you think about land rights, you think about the Mabo decision, because it was successful, because of these smaller struggles, they weren't successful, you don't hear about them as much?
Absolutely. And this is why we love this particular story, because even though there's many examples of these stories, and I'm sure there were lots of these going on, you know, all around the world, really. It's not just in Australia. But when you have something like this that's written down and it's all recorded, the inquiry in 1881, it's basically, you can't deny it. It's all the words are there and you can see that the Aboriginal people were being heard from, which just doesn't happen, especially back then. To have Aboriginal voices recorded is quite amazing. So I think the fact that we've got something here that we've got a story to tell, there's a victory in there that we can all sort of learn from, I guess, and be inspired by. But it was, you know, a lot of things when in Aboriginal culture, stories are passed down orally. So, you know, we talk about them, we tell our grandchildren and that sort of thing. But in sort of the white world, I guess, it's more about things being recorded and written down and everything like that. So to have that this story written down like that is why I think it's so much stronger and why it's really important, this particular one.
Yeah. And have you uncovered any similar stories while researching for this play?
Well, the funny thing is that along the way, particularly when we toured in Victoria, we had a lot of ancestors come to see the show, which was amazing and really daunting as well, especially when you meet a character you're playing's great-great-uncle or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, especially just before you go on stage.
no pressure.
But, yeah, exactly. I reckon you're like, oh, I hope I'm doing it justice. But there's also people that sort of stand up and say, oh, well, hang on, you know, this is great, but there was also a story, I was from Lake Tyres or I was a bit north or south or whatever, and we were going through the same thing, or my great-grandmother was a part of the Stolen Generation, or we were going through the same thing. So, yeah, there was just so many stories that people kept telling us. We have Q&A sessions after the shows quite often, and that's a time where people love to sort of say, you know, what they know and their stories and that kind of thing. So, yeah, more and more examples each time we do the show, really.
Wow. And who do you play in the play?
Well, we all play various roles. You know, 'cause I think the original cast, when they first did it, it was basically just reading out all the verbatim.
Right.
And it was just the entire inquiry. And I think it went for about 3 hours.
Oh, wow.
yeah, exactly. So, really engaging stuff, but really intense as well. So we've sort of narrowed it down. It's like about an hour show, and it's sort of dramatized, and we also comment on it along the way. So I think it's a lot more sort of engaging, and you can sort of really listen to the really important bits in the story. So yeah, we sort of jump between about 7 different characters, between Aboriginal characters and also, you know, the European characters that were there at the time. So yeah, quite a few.
But speaking of originals, Jack Charles will be joining you this week for the Q&A right after.
Yeah, which is great. I think he was going to come to another one in Victoria, but he couldn't make it. He was, of course, played the original narrator and that in the story, which is now played by Trevor Jamison, who's also got a beard very similar to Jack.
That's quite a beard.
Yeah, it's quite a beard, yeah. People comment on it all the time. It's almost more famous than he is. But, yeah, we can't wait to... I haven't met Uncle Jack yet, so it'll be really good to have him there. And, yeah, he's such a great character and personality. So, yeah, it'll be really good. And he'll be, I think, facilitating the Q&A sessions.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be even better. So, yeah.
Wow. I mean, living legend in the room. Doing Q&A, real-life struggles. Who was part of the Stolen Generation, part of the government policies. Incredible. But it's only being performed for one day only on Wednesday. Any reason why are you touring back in Victoria?
Yeah, I think we've got two shows. We've got a matinee and a evening performance. We don't spend too long in each town as we go to. Unfortunately, when we get to places like Parramatta and that, we don't get to perform more shows. But yeah, we've got to head up north and end up to Toowoomba and then in Darwin. So yeah, still a few places to go.
Excellent. Well, it sounds incredible. But Jesse, thank you so much for talking to us here on 2SER this morning.
No worries. Thanks heaps, Sophie.
No worries. That is Jesse Butler, one of the performers in Corranderk. You can see the show this Wednesday at Riverside Theatres in at Parramatta. There's a show at 11 a.m. as well as 7:30 p.m. and they will have a special Q&A hosted by Uncle Jack Charles. We'll put all those details, including tickets, on at 2ser.com. Going to jump back into the music before we're joined by our pop culture expert, Blake Howard. But to get you there, here's a tune from Shelley Short and the Sure Shots. This is I Am Free from Wake the Dreamers. Shelley Short and the Sure Shots there with Wake the Dreamers. I Am Free from her album Wake the Dreamers. You're here on it to SER with me, Sophie Lai, on It's So Hot Now, weekly dose of arts and culture. But now it's time for...
Let's go! Atomic batteries to power, turbines to speed.
Roger, ready to move out.
Holy smokes, Batman. It's Gaggle of Geeks with
Blake Howard
and Sophie Lai.
Good morning, Blake Howard of Graffiti with Punctuation.
Hello, Soph. Hello, geeks. What a freaking week we've had.
Oh, so much happening. So we've had a Wonder Woman pace spat, maybe, or maybe not. We don't know anymore. It's all up in the air. We've had a new Game of Thrones trailer drop. We've had some news about a potential Watchmen TV series. But the big one, Blake, the big one. What happened this week?
Well, the Han Solo original sort of origin film.
What happened
this
week?
The Star Wars universe seemed to be moving along beautifully. Written by Lawrence Kasdan, who is obviously part of The Empire Strikes Back and about a million other amazing films, steering the film, and Chris Lord, Phil Miller and Chris Lord, the folks behind the Lego Movie and, 21 Jump Street, are in the driver's seat. Great cast, Anson Elgort, the childish freaking Gambino himself, as Lando Calrissian, it was looking great. And then this week, those two directors got fired from the gig. And by all accounts, it's one of those classic Hollywood things, which is due to creative differences, directionally different things that they wanted out of the film. Star Wars, the people of Star Wars, Lucasfilm, led by Kathy Kennedy, has said, no, we're going to go in a different direction. And so it's a really... it's an interesting one, and their replacement happened really quickly, was speculated on super quickly, and happened really quickly, and the replacement is actually Ron Howard, like the immensely talented and enduring great filmic talent that is Ron Howard has kind of stepped in. But it's this weird, you've got weird feelings about it. It's not quite as egregious as what I feel is the worst one, which is the Edgar Wright being kicked off Ant-Man, which I think is like...
desecration.
I still think it's sinful. As sinful as a movie hiring and firing gets. But it leaves you in a kind of weird place because Ron Howard is an immensely versatile and talented director, and some great people, great tweeters, great voices in the of Star Wars repute that I sort of follow. They talk about Ron Howard's, one of his last films was that amazing Beatles documentary 8 Days a Week, which came out last year, which, they're like, he made an amazing film that I think was nominated for a stack of awards by compiling footage from other people. So maybe he is the best person to do this film. I don't know, Soph. What do you think? What are your initial thoughts? Because I'm a Star Wars geek through and through, but as I think I ranted about on our last gaggle about Star Wars, I'm only looking forward. I have not got any... I don't really care about its navel-gazing into the past with previous characters. I'm way more excited about what's happening in the series going forward.
Like, you were one of the, probably the only person I know that just had so many issues with Rogue One, and I'm like, it was a beautiful film. And you're like, I just had too many issues. No. Future owner. And, this cast for me, it's just, just having Childish Gambino / Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian, it's like, this is a little too perfect. I can't wait to see it. And I don't mind a bit of navel-gazing because it's such a rich universe with such rich stories. I don't mind going back into the past and exploring that. But with this whole debacle that's just unfolded in a week and resolved within a week, it's been a bit, has this been ongoing for a while? And Ron Howard, hit and miss with me. Like, some things amazing, other things I'm like, oh yeah, that's all right. So I'm not sure which way he will take the film.
Yeah, look, Howard's a director that, I think he's a director that I think probably could have been more renowned if he stuck in a lane, so to speak. Like, he's a very, but he's a guy who kind of wants to experience everything. He's very, extremely versatile. Whereas if you look at things like, Frost Nixon and probably Apollo 13, he's absolutely stellar ones. Mm-hmm. But he's worked with Lucasfilm before. He did Willow for George Lucas years and years ago. We saw him do that. I'm Chris Lord and Phil Miller Han solo film I'm way more excited for than a Ron Howard solo film, just because it's an older, more tried voice and a director we've seen many times before.
Yeah.
They are ruthlessly protective of their brand, and mm-hmm. I think that, you know, Kathy Kennedy is already showing that they've got an uncompromising vision about what their brand is, and they're not afraid. They're not ever going to let a director compromise it. They'll fire people, they'll rewrite, they'll reshoot it to death, but they will not let someone mess with what their ultimate vision is. So, yeah. Really interesting stuff.
Well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see till next year when more tidbits leak out, or until the film actually is released. Who knows if it still will be released?
Who cares? Let's go with Rian Johnson. That's what we want to see. Rian Johnson, The Last Jedi. That's what we want to see first.
And breathe, and breathe, and breathe. All right. Though, Blake, one of our favorite shows wrapped up this week. So exciting. American Gods.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, American Gods. Look, we talked about the first half of the series that I kind of reviewed, and we've been holding off to sort of review the final four episodes as they've gone to air. They're all available right now, so get on that if you haven't already. Look, it's a tremendous series, and this second half of the series cements it as the extremely ambitious and crazy series that it is, even more. You know, great sort of moral fables interwoven with this awesome versions of technology and myth and all of it clashing together. The performances are still outstanding. I think Gillian Anderson, for me, almost steals the show in the same way that Ian McShane steals the show.
Yeah.
She's playing media, the god of media. It continues on the path that it goes down. I think where I love the show is how it kind of is fleshing out characters. It's kind of telling sort of plots and subplots of tales that are mirroring one another in different time periods, and having people narrate these stories about how gods came to America. And then the final episode is just, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but the final episode, I saw someone tweet out, and I'm going to totally, take this as a gospel quote, which is the final episode of American Gods is Hannibal Good. It's the entire series. Really culminates so strong, and we've got hopefully a continuing series that's going to keep delivering as strong as it. It's just, I had such a great time with this show, for me it just got better and better. What about you, Sir?
Oh, amazing. And it's only such a tiny part of the book, like it's only like a fifth in of the book, but the finale didn't happen in the book, so no one knows what's going on. Oh my God! Like, wow, it was, as you mentioned, just the little side stories. I love that because, they fleshed out so much more of a character that just kind of popped up here and there. And then just seeing her backstory made you understand her so much more. And it's just so good to see this. And my favorite bits are definitely the, somewhere in America where they kind of delve into the deity's past, how they got to America. It's so beautifully shot. Amazing.
it's also like, you know, the first part of the series, I think you're kind of just so overwhelmed by the way that it clashes with myth. But as the series sort of solidifies, it really becomes like a political and sort of cultural document, like mm-hmm. of all this melting pot of America, yeah. And all these cultures sort of smashing together. And that weird conflict between, you know, the cultureless America where you're the individual and it doesn't matter where you come from, or it shouldn't matter where you come from, and then that sort of racial undertones and those sorts of things that are going through the entire show. I think that's, for me, is where it starts to be so amazing and starts to kind of hit those strides of, you know, the original seasons of True Blood, which are massive political allegories for what's happening. So it's a really, you know, it's a really dense show and a really dense book that just keeps rewarding. So I'm stoked at how strong it was, and I think there's just so much more to offer.
Oh, well, season two was renewed back in May, which is awesome, especially for a Brian Fuller show, because you never know.
You never know. It's like, if you don't renew this by now, it may never appear on TV again. That's pretty much the Brian Fuller, like, you are rolling your dice with your commitment to a Brian Fuller show. You really are.
But Blake, speaking of American Gods, guess what?
Oh, I know this, so if you don't have to make me guess. You spoke to the American God himself.
I did.
Ricky Whittle, people. Shadow freaking Moon sat in the same chair that I sat in.
Yes, he did.
Ah, that's awesome.
It is. Do you want to hear a bit of it now?
I'd love that.
All right, here is Ricky Whittle talking about American Gods, the star of the show here on 2SER.
Let's talk about quite possibly the greatest show on earth.
Totally.
American Gods on Amazon Prime Video. It may feature a little bit of me. I may get naked. I'm just going to put it out there.
Oh.
I may get naked. If that's not going to entice you, we have Ian McShane, Gillian Anderson, Peter Stormare, Orlando Jones, Emily. Your very own Emily Browning.
I know, right?
I mean, come on. She's one of your own.
But, whoa, epic finale.
Yeah. It's pretty impressive, and it's quite a cliffhanger. For those who don't know, the book came out in 2001, American Gods, by the incredible Neil Gaiman, who's a rock star of the book world. But for fans of the book, everything that you loved in the book is going to be in the show and is going to be throughout the seasons. But we've fleshed out a lot of the book and a lot of characters who are sporadic, like Mad Sweeney, Laura, Bilquis. Their characters have kind of been expanded. So there's a lot that's not in the book, like the season finale, a huge cliffhanger.
I was like, what is this? Which, I do not remember this.
It's not in the book. So, you know, it's a way to keep everyone coming back, you know. So people who are fresh to the show are like, what the heck have I just watched? You know, we're known as WTF TV. It's kind of a mind-blowing, kind of crazy watch. Our show is a book. It's a very famous book, and it has a story, it has a storyline, and we kind of follow that, and we're very patient.
And congratulations, season two. You always never know with a Brian Fuller show.
All you can guarantee with a Brian Fuller show is genius, visual masterpieces, and there is nothing like this on TV. You know, he's an incredible man, an incredible producer, showrunner. He constantly produces great work. You know, Michael Green, our other producer and showrunner, there's a lot of quality there, a lot of visual creative genius. They write incredible stories. They've made this kind of template, this blueprint that the book is, into an incredible adaptation to screen, to the point where fans of the book are obsessed and say it's possibly even better than the book because it does expand upon so much of everything that they love, which is not heard of. But for some reason, everyone who read the book is loving the show, and everyone who's new to the book and new to Neil Gaiman and the show is loving it too. So we really have the best of both worlds, and with Brian and Michael kind of leading the charge, we're looking to be here for numerous years. The first season covers the first 120 pages of a very, very long book, a fifth of the book. So with Neil Gaiman writing a sequel at the moment, a second book, American Gods, and Anansi Boys. These are other spin-offs. Anansi Boys, Monica to Glen, Black Rock. These are spin-offs that kind of are in the same world. This really has got legs to go for a good 6-7 years. I've definitely signed on for a long time. I'm not looking to go anywhere. So I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be around for a while, and it seems to be making the right waves as well. It's even though it came out in 2001 and we wrapped in November before the Trump inauguration, all that craziness and the political heated climate. All these incredible themes that are now in the headlines today were already in the book. We're already in the show. So we've actually, by accident and unfortunately, become extremely current and relevant political-wise. You know, we talk about immigration, religion, racism, homophobia, women's rights, you know, gun control. This is all stuff that's kind of happening and going on in America and hitting the headlines with Trump and stuff. So, you know, it's great that we've got this platform to not just entertain but to educate. And raise awareness of these important themes. You know, we've got a gay Muslim scene between two incredible actors, Musa and Omid, play the Salim and Jin, and it's illegal in some countries, punishable by death.
Yep.
And you kind of expected a kind of backlash and this and that, but at the end of the day, it was two incredible actors playing a beautiful story, and it was shot so wonderfully. It's an incredible love story. And these are stories that we need to be telling. And it shouldn't be groundbreaking TV because this is the world we live in. You know, love is love. And you know, this is where some people need to catch up. But it's making the right noises. And my favorite tweet that came to my social media was some girl said, my dad didn't bat an eyelid between the gay Muslim scene, but lost his mind when he heard that Ricky Whittle was British. So that is
really
that's the reaction I want. You know, when you're focused on the fact that, wait, Ricky's British? What? That's outrageous. And you're not, you know, upset by, you know, the themes and the topics we're touching. That's important, because all of a sudden, you know, we're educating the world, and that's important. Keep these themes in the headlines, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's still just a TV show. So enjoy the roller coaster that we are providing.
But the thing, like I love the show because it did expand on so many other characters that you mentioned, like Laura and Matt Sweeney. Because I feel like had it just followed the book, it would just been two dudes on a road trip. It might have been a bit more of a sausage fest.
Two dudes on a road. You're talking about me and Ian McShane.
To be fair,
I mean that is like award-winning TV and my favorite part of the show. What are you talking about? No, yeah, I get it, though. No, it would have been a sausage fest, and that's why Brian and Michael and Neil as well, who's been involved from the very beginning in, you know, casting and episodes and storytelling, they wanted to make sure that the female presence was larger. They wanted to expand upon the universe. You know, Brian Fuller described this as Avengers with gods, and that's a great way of explaining, you know. These two kind of like sides, you know, the old biblical mythical gods waging war against the new deities that we all worship today in technology, media, fame, celebrity, and, you know, poor shadows stuck in the middle. But it's important to kind of get a break sometimes from the main narrative, which is Shadow's story, you know, from cynic to believer, to be awakening. To be awoken in this crazy magical world of fantastical things happening to him with Mr. Wednesday, you know, you've kind of got these side stories, you know, with Bilquis, the goddess of love, Queen Sheba, played by the beautiful Yatiri Badaki, who is a powerhouse and a fresh name in America, in Hollywood, but not for very much longer. She's going to be doing great things. Bruce Lanley's another one. Orlando Jones could win an award from one speech, one scene. He is that good.
He raves
about racism, about the plight of black people in America and how they came over on a slave ship. But hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, they will still be persecuted by the white man, by police and things like that. But the writing is incredible, and it's not forcing political issues down your throat. It's just, we probably raise more questions than answer, you know. We're not taking sides, we're just kind of throwing stuff up there, and we want you to discuss it at home, you know. What's your perspective? Because at the end of the day, even the simple themes is that it's old gods versus the bad guys who are the new gods. But that's about perspective, because Shadow first meets Mr. Wednesday, who introduces him to the old gods. So of course he's going to see the new gods as the enemy. But if he had met Media, played by Gillian Anderson, or Tech Boy, then all of a sudden Mr. Wednesday and the old gods would have been the bad guys. So it's all about perspective. And at the end of the day, we're trying to tell you just to believe in something. We all have a struggle. We all have a journey in life. Everyone is going through their day and their own battles. And whether it's biblical, mythical gods you believe in, whether it's your iPhone, your favorite TV show, your favorite actor, singer, whatever it is you need to get you through that day, that's what's important. Just because you believe in a certain god, it doesn't mean mine's any less real or less powerful. To me, it's okay to coexist, and it's just about believing in something.
Wow, Blake, what'd you think?
I'm that jealous. I'm that jealous that he is now your husband. It's awesome.
All right. But Blake, thanks for gaggling out with us on Gaggle of Geeks.
See you, dude. Great show. See you guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Blake Howard there. Catch all these reviews and movie news on Graffiti with Punctuation, or at Blake is Batman on Twitter, or at us at 2SER. Also, big thanks to Ricky Whittle, the star of American Gods. What a legend. What a god. What a hunk, might I just add. You can hear the full chat. It's quite an extensive chat, about 20 minutes. You can hear it all on 2SER.com/hot-right-now. We'll head on there and listen to the full chat. It is worth it, I tell you. We're going to jump back into the music now. Here's a tune from People Under the Stairs. This one's called The Strand. We'll be right back.
So it's 2 a.m., I'm at it again. Me and the beat tight like a pad in the pen. Juicy gin, teller and pen, money and sin. Contestant on your fright night, no one can contend. Just give me your windbreaker, and I'm off in the night. Rap burglar, murder the first herb. Who claiming they never heard the rhyme giant divine. I do it my way, hydroplaning on the highway. Leaning sideways, crime pays, these rhymes slay. Leave them in the dust, like the angel of music. George, we trust. Rhyme pattern ridiculous, the conspicuous, smoked out, smoked out. You're rushing the stage and you choked out. Hot in the Death Valley in the summer, you bitch. Make a wish, blow it out. I'm the re-up in the drought. Mix the stout with the lager, powered up like a lager. So beat me on the news when I silence your favorite blogger. Bam! One shot, knock, knock him out the box, and I'm off to the land. Study the flow, I preach beat like Francis Bacon. You tuned in to genuine history in the making. When will the peace stop? Nobody knows. I construct prose with the tenor that my tenure bestows. In closed caption, you see what I'm rapping right on the screen like a limousine commercial. My rhapsody in between the blue and red. It's life in my teen city. We'll be indebted just the next episode like Dre said from prenatal. Success is not final, failure is fatal. So I wake up every day with the plan to play like potato. And coming straight out the underground, I palaver with all my fans and find a common ground that's real. We press it on vinyl, it can't be killed. If you throw it away, eternity rocking the landfill. Until I'm refound or reground, you never know. But infinitely longer than a dat pip download. Just 1010 binary fairies are very different from the heroes from raps. Yes, the years the present, but I'm still here. He's still here, we still drink beer and take it to the stage at least half of the year. So when you see double F, that's the Southwest. Getting drunk with no baggage in the overhead, just throw up the funk. It's not dead, in fact it's very alive now. The OGs with OG Kush blow out your SoundCloud as the strength. Rhythm and rhyme, rhythm and rhyme, rhythm and motherfucking rhyme. I got rhythm and rhyme, rhythm and rhyme, rhythm and motherfucking rhyme. You walk a rhythm and rhyme.
Open Inner West Festival is back. Over 10 days, revel in 57 cultures across the Inner West.
Unearth diverse communities, from Club Koori to the Greek Sweets Festival, Mongolian, Peruvian, Balkan festivities and more.
Check out hip-hop competitions, films, spoken word, live music and food tours.
Festival kicks off June 16. For full program details, go to innerwest.newsouthwales.gov.au/Open Inner West.
Inner West Council, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
Get your face burned up and Fraser. Get your house this new year.
that, there is Mexicans Trapped in Rubble, probably one of the greatest band names I've ever heard. That one is Jed's House from the Lobster Man of Archives, Volume 1, the Cubby House Fire of 77. On top of that, you also heard a bit of hip-hop from People Under the Stairs with The Strand. You're here on So Hot Now with me, Sophie Light, your weekly dose of arts and culture.
Amazing talent.
Live radio broadcasts.
Fantastic events.
You're on 2SER.
Since the implementation of the lockout laws in 2014, Keep Sydney Open have been rallying for not only for our rights party, but to keep Sydney's nighttime economy and culture alive. This coming Saturday, they're holding a different kind of a rally with Meet Me in the Cross, a mini festival, one would say, in King's Cross. We're joined now by founder Tyson Coe. So, Tyson, we've had three successful daytime rallies. We've had one nighttime rally that was knocked back by the court slash police. Can you talk us through that process and what happened with the knocked back one?
Sure. Well, we had a rally planned for King's Cross, which was meant to take place at nighttime, and the police commissioner took myself and Keep Sydney Open to the Supreme Court. And unfortunately, they won, which I think had some pretty significant ramifications for people wanting to hold peaceful protests within New South Wales. Now, that was a very arduous process, even though it happened in a very short space of time. So I got served with papers at about 6 p.m. and then I had to appear in court pretty much at 9-10 a.m. the following day. So I had to get lawyers together. I had three barristers, and put together all the affidavits and everything. And as a model litigator, I think the police really showed some really poor form, because it meant that instead of engaging with us in dialogue, they had this whole legal proceeding cooked up without giving us enough time to get enough evidence and reports together to be able to respond to them. So I think it was really shady on their part. However, we got a lot of publicity out of it. So it kind of blew up in their face, because we know that the police are under duress in this state, where they, particularly in light of the Lint siege and a few drug raids which have turned up nothing, it's just shown how heavy-handed a lot of the police have been with some of their operations. You know, I think that they're not really reaching out to the community in a very positive way. Now, we ended up having a rally in Martin Place during the daytime, like good little advocates. Mm. And I think we've shown that. I think throughout that whole process with getting knocked back, that the police weren't really prepared for a large amount of people to hit the streets of King's Cross, even though our rally was projected to have about 5,000 to 7,000 people.
Yep.
But on a regular night in King's Cross, there were 27,000 people a few years ago.
Mm.
So it just makes, I think, were the police ever prepared to deal with that many people. And of course, we saw a little bit of violence on the streets, which the police weren't really dealing with in the best possible way.
Yeah, I mean, this with Meet Me in the Cross, it's a different type of party. It's not a rally per se. Is that just to counter the fact that we won't, if there's a march again, you don't want to hit the courts again?
No, no. What the reason why we're doing this festival in King's Cross is, well, there's actually several reasons. One is that we've made our point. We've had three very successful rallies that were on the front page of the news, and we feel like we've highlighted this cause very well, and we even managed to contribute to the ousting, well, not the ousting, but the resignation of a premier. So with this, we wanted to reframe the conversation a little bit, and also Keep Sydney Open as a group as being one that doesn't necessarily protest or doesn't just protest, but we also actively contribute to the creation and facilitation of culture within this city. And it's a very positive thing that we're doing. We're actually paying artists and labels and promoters, and we're encouraging people into a precinct that a lot of people think is dead.
Mm.
And it's not. You know, there are still some really fantastic venues there. You know, people still go out to King's Cross, albeit not in the same numbers that they were before. But we want people to enjoy the inner city area, because if not, then all of the venues really will go out of business and you're going to end up with nothing in the inner city except for apartments.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned it before how the police are getting a bit more heavy-handed. I mean, we've seen Club 77 raided in Darlinghurst, and then we saw the King's Cross Hotel shut down during a noise complaint at 9:30 for a Vivid gig, the biggest tourist-like event in Sydney. What's the possibility of them even attempting to maybe even shut down this party because of noise complaints at 9:30 p.m.?
Look, you can never tell what the police will and won't do. All I know is that we have consulted with police with this event, and even though they did express a few concerns, I think they're on board. I think they see this as a positive thing, and we do have the support of the Potts Point partnership, the business partnership there, as well as a lot of the local businesses on the ground. So this is a very positive thing that we're doing. But yes, it is a little bit concerning. I mean, it wasn't just that King's Cross Hotel gig. There was also all the sniffer dogs out the front of Goldfrapp, which was another Vivid event, you know, and they were strip searching people on the way in for just a regular gig, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I really do think that there are major concerns with New South Wales Police at the moment. I think they're very, very out of touch. And I think that they are doing what will soon be irreparable damage to the live music scene in New South Wales, because it just seems like a police state here.
Yeah, I mean, the heavy-handedness, I mean, with all the increase of sniffer dogs, but they're also under such huge scrutiny, as you mentioned before, because of the lint siege. Why are they shooting themselves in the foot?
Look, I think they are. I think they are. At this stage, I think that the way that the police are managed, that they are too arrogant to acknowledge that, really, which is a big shame, because we deal with police all the time and there are some absolute legends within the New South Wales Police Force who get it. They know that they're there to do a job and not overstep that mark, and that they're there to support the activities that that the community wishes to partake in, whether that's live music, whether that's festivals, or what have you, and I do think that that there needs to be a very frank and honest conversation about police and their role in managing the activities and wishes and desires of people that just want to live a cultural life in the city.
Is it a trickle-down effect from the New South Wales government, considering when Gladys Berejiklian came into power, she's like, we're keeping the lockout laws because we want mums and dads want to know that their kiddies are safe out at night. Is it a trickle-down effect from that, you know, this whole very patronising kind of outlook on who goes out at night?
Yeah, I think so. Definitely, without a doubt, you know. I mean, I think people are very short-sighted about the history of Sydney and the history of King's Cross. You know, there were shoot-ups, there were stabbings, there were the turf wars in King's Cross, you know. There was rife and rampant police corruption, particularly centred around King's Cross. And now it's more civil than ever. Young people drink less now than at any stage in Australia since 1963, you know. I mean, we live in a very, very civil society, and yet the rules and the regulations and the policing is coming down harder than ever. And I do think that there is a bias against certain communities. I think the music community in general, but also I've heard a lot of stories about promoters and venues getting tapped by police, targeting their event because they're a reggae promoter, and that there's going to be a lot of marijuana there, about hip hop gigs. I've heard direct criticism from police trying to stop dance music events because they don't like electronic music, because they think where there's electronic music, there's drugs. You know, I just think that there's so many more negative things going on in society, whether it's people manufacturing ice, whether that's domestic violence going on in the community, that deserve more attention instead of trying to shut down peace-loving, music-loving citizens.
Mm. For sure. The Lansdowne did reopen, though, this week, which is kind of good news. Do you see more venues reopening their doors soon?
There's some positive things going on in this city, and I feel as though a lot of people are sick of the lockouts and they're sick of the government telling them what to do. And I think even though, yes, we are really constrained in this city, I think a lot of people are moving towards wanting to... I guess, live as if we are living in a free city. And so I think a lot of people are pushing up against those boundaries. And so we are seeing places open up like the Lansdowne, like the Flinders have reopened as well. And I hear that Hugo's is going to be reopening soon. And even though because of the lockouts regime, it's not the best business climate to be operating in, but I think a lot of people are preparing for there to be some movement within government. And essentially that's why we're doing... the festival as well, because regardless of whether there's lockouts or not, artists still need to be paid.
Yeah.
People still want to go out and have a good time, and there's still venues in the King's Cross that are fantastic and really passionate and want to put on great events.
Absolutely. So who is playing at Meet Me in the Cross?
Well, we're really excited because there is a really huge lineup of both people that have hit the big time and people that are really hungry and passionate and are just working their way up through the industry. So our headliners are Hermitude, Nina Las Vegas, and also Fundamentals, who are all doing DJ sets. And then we've got some live sets from Mezco, which is a fantastic up-and-coming band, Dappled Cities, who are just indie legends within Sydney. And then we've got a bunch of favourite DJs around town, like Kato, Ben Fester, 82E, Andy Garvey. We've got the team from Zoo Project and Astral People DJs, Future Classic DJs. So there's going to be, just a whole smorgasbord of live acts and DJs across 8 different venues.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're really excited. I mean, it's so much more work. It's so much more work than putting on a rally.
Feels like the Cross back 5 years ago.
Yeah, well, we'll see. Hopefully we'll be.
Well, Tyson, we can't wait to see what happens at the festival, but thanks so much for joining us here on 2SER.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Tyson Coe, they're the founder of Keep Sydney Open. Follow their Facebook page for all the updates, and tickets are available via Eventbrite. So we'll put those details up on 2SER.com as well. But if you want to avoid going from venue to venue asking, oh, is there tickets left? Probably best to go online and do it. You are here listening to On So Hot right now with me, Sophie Lowe. Time here is just about up. Big thanks to all our guests. Jesse Butler from Corinda. You can see it at Riverside Theatres this Wednesday. There's a performance at 11 a.m. as well as 7:30 p.m., including a Q&A by the legendary Jack Charles. That's happening at Riverside Theatres in Parramatta. Big thanks to Blake Howard. Catch all his pop culture goodness and reviews on Graffiti with Punctuation. Big, big, big thank you to American God star Ricky Whittle, who dropped by earlier this week. We have full extended chat on 2SER.com. And as thank you to you for tuning in every week. Don't go anywhere. Gons is in the house with Dub is in the air. But I'll leave you with a message from our sponsors. I'll catch you in a couple of weeks' time. I'm away next week, but in a couple of weeks' time for more arts and culture on So Hot right now. I'm Sophie. Bye.
Experience a winter wonderland in Parramatta these school holidays. 17th.